I want to welcome everybody to class. I am going to take a couple extra seconds here to make sure that we're actually live. Okay, I see that we are on Facebook, and I'm going to check YouTube quick. Remember last Sunday, I thought we were streaming and we weren't. Eli, can you check YouTube? I'm going to check the church.
Upcoming.
So it hasn't connected yet? So again, if you're just tuning in, bear with me. I'm just making a couple checks to make sure that we're in order here.
Oh. Waiting for Grace Life Bible.
Okay. We're live on the church website and we're live on Facebook. Still waiting for it. Will you monitor YouTube for me?
Yep.
If you would. So when I tested it, how many of you guys saw yesterday we were here for the board meeting and I ran a test and I just like live streamed the wall? So it was just... it was just me live streaming the wall.
You should have sang a song or something.
No, I'm not doing that. It took more time to connect to YouTube than it did to connect to Facebook. So I'm fairly confident that it will work. I know it's on Facebook and I know it's on the website, so I know that worst case scenario I can download it from those locations and put it on YouTube if I need to. So I'm gonna go ahead. But will you still monitor it for me, Eli?
What was that?
Will you still monitor and tell me if it comes up on YouTube?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to welcome everybody to class this morning. Sorry for the housekeeping issues. Last Sunday, if you don't recall, I thought I was live streaming and I wasn't, and I had to redo things. So we were here yesterday for the board meeting, and so I tried to fix it, and I thought I had it fixed. Seemed like I had it fixed. I know it's fixed to YouTube and the church's website, but we're just waiting for confirmation that it's on YouTube. But I'm going to go ahead and get started, because if for some reason it's not on YouTube, then I can pull it down and put it up from a different source, okay? So you guys should have in front of you lesson 190, the AV 1611, assessing its preliminary contents. Now, these are a little bit hefty, okay? I'm going to be up front with you. We're not going to get through all this today, and we're just going to kind of go through this at the pace that it takes to go through it. If you're joining us right now live, still nothing. If you're joining us right now live, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, you can scroll down and click on the entry right here for January 15, 2023, and you can load the notes here for lesson 190, okay? So again, I'm going to keep going. I know we're in those other spots. Worst case scenario, I can pull the video. It's not going to be too surprising if it's not another minute and a half or something before it connects. So... all that being said, let's get started. The other thing I want to mention, okay, to fix the problem of not live streaming, I re-recorded from my office this week, lesson 189, okay? So I have fixed that problem. Lesson 189 is now up. And it is me from my office teaching through the material like I normally would do for a midweek or Thursday morning message, all right? This is a little bit different than what I said last week. I did not read verbatim, word for word, everything that was said in the notes, and I have a few extra things that I covered there that I did not cover in the lesson last Sunday, okay? But it is there. I've saved it there. Instead of coming in and redoing it for all of you guys and boring you by having you listen to the same lesson twice, this is what I decided to do, okay? So, let's go back. Still nothing? What's that?
Yep.
Okay. In lesson 189, we considered the first edition of the AV as well as the He-She Bible controversy. In doing so, we concluded the following, all right? So these are some conclusions from last week. Number one, the AV of 1611 was only published in a large folio size. So again, that's this size right here, the large folio size. It was only published in 1611 in the large folio size. Number two, the first folio edition is known popularly as the He Bible. So we concluded that the He Bible, with the variant at Ruth 3:15, the first edition was what is known popularly as the He Bible. All right. We also talked about reasons why the He-She distinction is not helpful in the notes from last week. Okay. Number three, a second folio edition, known popularly as the quote She Bible, was published in 1613. All right. So in 1613, there was a true second edition, and it is the second edition from 1613 that is known popularly as the She Bible. Okay? Still nothing? Okay. The first folio edition from 1611 went through two separate printings in 1611. This is evidenced by printing discrepancies in the 1611 folio He Bibles. Please see the notes from lesson 189 for more information. Now, I do want to just kind of show you one example of this, okay? This is Exodus. Is this Exodus? Where are we at here? Yeah, Exodus chapter 14. Look here at verse 10, all right? Exodus chapter 14, look here at verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lift up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. Now watch this. And the children of Israel lift up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. So does it repeat the same line, the same clause two times? Okay? And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. So obviously, if you go quickly in your Bible to Exodus 14:10, you'll see that that's a typo. Okay? That is a printer error. It's not intended for that clause that takes up three lines in the text to be there two times. It's a mistake. Still nothing? Okay. It's a mistake. Now, what ends up happening is, I don't have a picture of it. I looked all over the internet to try to find one, but there is not a picture of this particular verse. What ends up happening is this verse gets reprinted, and three lines are left blank in verse 10. So that the page ends in the same spot when they correct it, okay? So this is the kind of stuff that I was trying to get you to see last week when we were talking about this. So it is my belief that in 1611, the first edition was the He Bible, all right? Then there was a second printing of the He Bible that fixed certain printer errors like the one that we see right here in verse 10, where the line is repeated, all right? We can look at another one just briefly. Let's just look at one more. And I cover this.
Out of curiosity, did they change the page spacing, or how did they correct it?
They took out the repeated lines, and then they left a three-line blank.
Oh, that's how they did it.
At the end of verse 10 before verse 11, so that the page ended on the same at the same spot. Okay. So that's how they accounted for it initially in the reprint. Okay, now we could also go to Mark chapter 8 verse 33, and I can show you another one here. So here's a photograph of a 1611 Bible. Now, look here how this ends, all right? Notice that the word men ends on a line down here. So this verse has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines of text, with the verse 33 ending with the word men on a sixth line. Does everybody see that? Okay. Now, if I could find it quick, I have a picture of another edition that I took where the line ends on a, where there's only 5 lines. Let me just go back. This can be the quickest way to do it. There's a second printing of the 1611 folio edition where the word men is at the end of the 5th line. Okay? So this one has men on a 6th line. The other one has men ending here at the end of the sentence on the on a 5th line. And so obviously those are two different printings because they're not what? They're not the same. Somebody adjusted the type on the page to get that to come out that way, all right? And I show that in my video. I do show this in my video from Thursday. This picture of this, and it's probably going to take me too long to find, but it would be good to show you if I can do so relatively quickly. Okay, here's where I start talking about the discrepancies. And here I believe I found it. Okay, so if you guys look at this, this is a picture I took. I'm probably wasting too much time on this, but I want you to see this with your own eyes. Okay. Pause. So you see this here? Here's the same verse. My video window is covering it up here, but you can see that the word men is not at the bottom here. Okay, this is Mark chapter 8, verse 33. The word men is right here in the other printing, but it's not here on this one, which means that somebody did what? Somebody adjusted it, okay? So you can go back here and just make that quick comparison that there's the word men, and in the photo I showed you on the other one, the word men wasn't there, okay?
The other column ends in 5 lines, and yep. That one should too,
right.
Theoretically.
There's a discrepancy in how many lines are in that, how many lines of text are in that column, okay? Now, let's go back to the notes now. So still nothing?
Still nothing,
all right. So those are some takeaways. Now, if you look at the next point, I believe the 1611 He Bible is the result of a printer error and not the intentional choice of the translators. The following is a summary of my reasoning. All right? Now, everybody grab your Bible and go to Ruth chapter 3. So, I think that the 1611, after I've looked at this, spent hours looking at it, I think the 1611 is a printer error when it says he went into the city instead of she went into the city. All right? Now, I will tell you why here. If you would grab Ruth 3. First thing I want to do is to just read it, okay? Ruth chapter 3, and we'll start at verse 15. Ruth chapter 3, verse 15. Notice what it says. Also he said, bring the veil that thou hast upon thee, and hold it. And when she, that would be Ruth, held it, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her. Okay? And then it says, and she went into the city. That's what your standard 1769 text has, right? But then look at the next verse. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, so who's doing the action in the next verse? Ruth is, right? And those verses, those she pronouns are not disputed in the next verse, okay? So the very next verse has Ruth doing the action. Ruth is the one doing the activity, talking to Naomi, etc. Verse 16. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, Who art thou, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done to her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said to me, Go not empty unto thy mother-in-law. Now that is a fascinating statement. He's telling her not to go back to her mother-in-law what?
Empty.
So who is the one who is leaving to go? Who is the one who is getting up and getting into the city?
She
is. She is. You see that? She's the one who's doing the activity, and she's telling this to Naomi. Okay, verse 18. Then said she, "Sit, my." So now I believe this is Naomi talking, right? Then she said, "Sit, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he have finished this, until he have finished the thing this day." Okay, so in verses 16 and 17, who is the one doing the activity? It's Ruth. All right? Now, from my understanding, the Hebrew text here, for whatever reason, says he in chapter 3, verse 15. When it's translated, though, to make it make sense in English, it is my opinion that the translators render it as what?
She,
so that it fits with what else is going on. Does that make sense? Okay, now, let's go back to the notes. The controversy is caused because of a variant reading in Ruth 3:15. And he went into the city, and she went into the city. Wycliffe, Coverdale, Matthews, Matthews Prince Tyndale's translation of Ruth 3:15 after his martyrdom, a great Bible, Geneva Bible, Bishop's Bibles, as well as the Reams, all read she in Ruth 3:15. Okay? So, we could look at that too. We did that last Sunday, actually. We looked at Ruth 3:15. Let's do it again. Don't want that. Come on. There we go. So here's Wycliffe. He mete out 6 bushels of barley and put it on her and Shebar and entered the what? The city. Who's leaving and going into the city according to Wycliffe? Ruth is. Okay, let's go to Coverdale. Okay, Coverdale, right? And she went where? Into the city. Coverdale has she. Matthews publishes Tyndale's translation. And notice, and she got her into what? The city, okay? Great Bible, 1539, edited by Coverdale, revision of the Matthew's Bible, and she got her into where? The city. So Great Bible has the same thing. Geneva Bible, 1560, and she went into the city, okay? Bishop's Bible, following, which is a revision of the Great Bible, and she got her into what? The city. Reams Bible, Douay Reams, we can see here, and even it says, and she carried it and went where? So literally every English Bible before 1611 all have what?
She.
Then all of a sudden in 1611 we have he. Okay? Technically the Hebrew has he. But all these other versions, whether they're from Latin or from Hebrew, all have what?
She.
So you know that the King James translators were given the job of revising the Bishop's Bible, that the Bishop's Bible was to serve as the base text. We've covered this, right? And they were to compare it with the original language and other earlier modern English versions. And the only reading at this verse to compare it to is what? She, because that's the only reading that there was. All right, so let's go back to the notes. Is everybody with me here? Now look, folks, when you're going to study stuff like this, this is kind of the technicalities that you're forced to deal with to be clear about stuff, okay? Wycliffe, Coverdale, Matthews, Prince Tyndale's translation of Ruth 3:15 after his martyrdom, Great Geneva, Bishop's Bible, as well as the Reams, all read she in Ruth 3:15. Put a different way, the base text for the authorized version, i.e. the Bishop's Bible, as well as all prior English Bibles read she. I just proved that to you, okay? After checking Dr. Edward Craney Jacob's work on Bot 1602 that we surveyed in prior lessons, I believe that we are safe in concluding from what we can observe in the 1602 Bishop's Bible by the First Westminster Company that Ruth 3:15 was not revised. So what do I mean to say there? There are no handwritten annotations in Bob 1602 at Ruth 3:15, which means at that point in the translation process, did they leave the verse alone? Okay, let's go to the next point. A comparison between Ruth 3:15 and a 1602 bishops with the AV of 1611 reveals revision work was done on that verse after the production of Bob 1602, but before the publication of the 1611. So late in the process, did they elect to revise parts of Ruth 3:15? Okay, please consider the following images. So if you look at the top image, so I'm going to put these. So here is the bishops, okay? And he said again, bring the mantle that thou hast upon thee and hold it. And when she held it, he meted in 5 measures of barley and laid it on her. And she got her into where? The city, okay? Now look at the 1611. Okay, let's go clause by clause. Also he said, look at the first clause in the bishops. And he said again. So at some point, was that first clause revised? Mm-hmm. Yes or yes?
Yes?
Okay, good, yes, all right. Look at the second clause, 1602 bishops. Bring the mantle that thou hast upon thee. Look at the King James, 1611. Bring the veil that thou hast upon thee. So mantle is switched to what?
Veil.
Okay? And hold it. Both have and hold it. Look at the next sentence. It's bishops. And when she held it, he meted in 5 measures of barley. 1611. And when she held it, he measured 5 measures of what? Barley. So it was that part of it revised a little bit. Okay? Look at the next clause. And laid it on her. Bishops. King James. And laid it on her. Is that part the same?
Yeah.
Okay? And then let's look at the final clause. It's causing all the hullabaloo here. Bishops. And she got her into the city. Okay? Look at the 1611, and he went into the city. So, got into the city, the bishops, was revised to went into what? The city. Now, think about it, guys. Are there other prior English Bibles that read in that clause exactly the way the 1611 does? Here's the Geneva. That's the great. Sorry, I didn't want that one. I want this one. No, I don't want the Reams. Push the right button, Brian. I want Geneva. Okay, look at the Geneva. And she went into what? The city. So clearly at some point, was Ruth 3:15 revised slightly by the translators? When you compare the 1611 against the base text of the 1602? The answer is what?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so let's... We're on page 2, right? You guys are going to have a special reward at the judgment seat for dealing with me on all this stuff, okay? At some point, the 1602 bishop's text was revised by the King James translators. While there were other revisions made to the verse, note the change to the clause in question here. 1602, and she got her into the city. 1611, and he went into the city. Now, think about this. Clearly, are they thinking that the Geneva reading here is a better reading? She went into the city versus she got her into the city. You following that?
Yeah.
So if they're going to switch the reading there, why would they all of a sudden change she to what?
He
when everything else in English up to this point all has what?
She.
Clearly, in my mind, this is a what? This is a printer error. Okay, look at the next part. It is plausible to conclude that this revision work done that this revision work was done by the Committee of Final Review at Stationers Hall in 1610. Just because the bishops revised "gat" to "went" does not mean that they intentionally changed "she" to "he," as some, such as Norton and Campbell, have asserted. 1612, so this is the next year, saw the publication of two Roman-type quartos and two Roman-type octavos for personal use. Okay? So that would be the smaller size. An examination of Rue 315 in the quarto reveals that the "she" reading had been reinstated. Meanwhile, the octavos retained the "he" reading in Rue 315. According to A.S. Herbert's Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1525 through 1961, the 1612 octavo is a, quote, close reprinting of the folio of 1611, reproducing its special readings. Example, Genesis 10:16. We need to take that gap out between the colon there and 16. Ruth 3:15, and even the mistake in Exodus 14:10. Now, have we already looked at the mistake in Exodus 14:10? What's the mistake in Exodus 14:10? The fact that that line is that clause is repeated twice in the verse, right? Okay. So this 1612 octavo is a basic reprint of the 1611 folio in smaller size, but the 1612 quarto changes the reading. So go to the next page, and there's a picture of it for you. Okay. So notice. So this is a 1612 quarto. For you, I think it's on the top of page 3. But notice. Look at. And "she" went where? So the very next year in 1612, is that corrected?
Yeah.
It's corrected in the quarto?
Yes.
Not quattro.
Quarto.
Quarto. Okay. 1613, next point. 1613 saw the reading changed in both the second folio edition and retained in other smaller editions. So here it is. Here is the 1613 "she" Bible, 1613 black letter folio. Notice what it says. And "she" went into what?
The city.
The city. So this is a picture of it in the so-called "she" Bible. Okay? And then you can look at the next one. This is a 1613 Roman type. Notice, and it says, and "she" went where? Into the city. Look at the next point. In addition to the images above, I checked editions from 1616, 1617, 1629, 1638, and 1762, and the 1769, all of which read, "and she went into the city." The evidence is strong that "he went into the city," as in the 1611 folio, was a printer error that was quickly corrected in subsequent editions, thereby establishing "and she went into the city" as the standard reading. You guys following this?
Yeah.
Okay. Now listen, did it make more sense to read it that way when we just read the verse in context in Ruth 3? Who is the one that is doing the speaking and the activity in verse 16 and 17? It's Ruth, it's not Boaz. Mm-hmm. You following me?
Yeah.
Okay. Even modern versions, such as the ESV and New American Standard, read "she" in Ruth 3:15. Though the ASV, New American Standard Version, contains a footnote that some manuscripts read "he." Okay, so, does anybody have any questions about that? So I've done a lot of work on that since last Sunday. Obviously with the photos and the images and stuff, because even Mike Earthpalmer sent me an email and saying with some questions or whatever, and saying, "I think some people might have questions about this." I knew that was the case, so I looked at it a little bit more. Okay. Now, any other questions before we look at this last point in the review clarification section? Did we still never go live on YouTube? That's irritating. Anyway, so look at the top point on page 4. Lastly, this is a point that Brother Berg brought up in his unpublished essay on this topic that I quoted from last Sunday. Remember, he was talking about how The he, she creates a situation where sellers of material on the internet can exploit people who don't really know what's going on. Remember we talked about that a little bit, or I touched on that? So I have my own personal example of this, okay? Now I've shown you now in multiple lessons that this is a folio page. This is a 1611 page, okay? If you see anybody selling anything on the internet that is not this size, are they selling you the 1611? They are not selling you the 1611. And remember also last Sunday how I mentioned that somebody had gotten me a gift once. So here's the gift, okay? Now, notice what this says. So you tell me what you would think if you got this. An original leaf from the first edition of the 1611 King James Bible, then it says in small print, printed before 1650. Kind of small, and is a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
Does that make you think that you're getting a page from the 1611?
No. Something before 1650.
Yeah.
I think it's total false advertising to say an original leaf from the first edition of the 1611 King James Bible. It's not. Okay? Now let me show you the size of the leaf. That is not a 1611 page.
No, they burned the edges.
Okay. I'm thinking this is probably an octavo. This is not a quarto. This is an octavo. All right. And in the back, here's what they say. In the back, they say, this leaf, so that's this leaf, is from a King James Bible printed before 1650, has been authenticated and guaranteed to be at least 350 years old. Is that a lot different than what they're claiming in the big type on the front of this insert that they give you when you buy it? So this is what I'm saying, guys, and this is why I think Brother Berg makes a good point about this. I think there are people, sellers of material online, who are capitalizing on ignorance of people, of the consumer, and selling things that aren't really what people necessarily think they're being sold. Okay? Now, I will say, though, like, I am glad because now do we have a sample page of a octavo.
Yeah.
Now, this is from Isaiah chapter 13. Okay, but you can see the size discrepancy between the octavo and the folio. This is clearly being sold for personal use.
Yeah.
This is clearly being sold for pulpit use in a church. Okay? Any questions about that before we move on? So all that is review and clarification. So
admit it in the literature later on.
Yeah, they do admit it, but I still think it's sketchy.
Oh yeah.
I still think it's sketchy to say in big print on the front of the flyer, an original leaf from the first edition of the 1611, printed before 1650. Nah.
Yes, sir, okay.
I find that to be false advertising. Okay. Now, anyway, any questions about that before we get to sort of part two? Now, listen, we're not going to get through all this. All right. So what I'm going to do is we're going to get to a stopping point that makes sense. We'll stop there. Then I'm going to split the notes and make one lesson 190, and then we'll come back with lesson 191 as like the second half of that. But I'm going to split the notes for tracking with these lessons online. Okay? So let's look at the introduction. In this lesson, we want to begin looking at the 1611 as a historical artifact. Okay? Now, what do I mean by historical artifact? Was the 1611, is it a very important historical document? So let's just lay aside like the fact that it's the Bible for a minute and just talk about it as a historical artifact. I'm certainly not diminishing that. We spent hours talking about the readings that are in it and how they came about, okay? But what we want to talk about now is the 1611 as a historical artifact. What were its contents? We want to look at what was in it, all right? And what can we learn about the life and times of the translators by looking at what's included in their famous work? So to accomplish this, we will be following closely with Oxford professor Gordon Campbell's book, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. While there are other books that talk about aspects of the contents found within the AV of 1611, Campbell's is the most complete. Dr. Campbell offers the following physical description of the 1611 King James Bible. Okay? He says, quote, "A folio is a large book, and the first edition of the King James was large even by usual standards of folios." We've talked about that ad nauseum, right? Its thick pages measure approximately 11 inches by 16 inches. And that's what you'll find if you measure this out. You got roughly 11 inches across the top, 16 inches this way. Okay? The folio sheet. It was a heavy volume designed to sit on a lectern in a church, and as the title page explains, it was appointed to be read in churches. All right? At the beginning of most surviving copies is a thick section of preliminaries, 74 pages. So the 74 pages of preliminary content in a 1611 before you even get to the book of Genesis. Okay, 74 pages consisting of, number one, a title page. Number two, a dedicatory epistle to King James. Number three, a preface from the translators to the reader. Number four, a calendar. Number five, an almanac. Number six, a table for the calculation of Easter. Number seven, a table and calendar setting out the order of the Psalms that should say, and lessons plural, to be said at morning prayers throughout the year. A list of books of the Testaments and the Apocrypha, or a what we would call a table of contents page, okay? The royal coat of arms and the Latin phrase indication that the book was printed by, quote, authority of the king. Genealogies, a table of the place names, should say place names, plural, in Canaan, and then a map of Canaan. So there's 74 pages of preliminary material in a 1611 that include all of that information. All right? And then we can end the quote, "The preliminaries are followed by 1,464 unnumbered double column pages of text." And that would be like we can see here, okay? Pages not numbered, but does it have two columns? Okay? Any questions about that?
I caught something this morning because you had showed an old Bible. It wasn't the 1600 one, but you showed it online. And you showed those pages in that Bible before Genesis.
Yes. That was the Family Bible published in 1871. It's massive.
Yeah.
I brought that in and showed it in a few lessons maybe 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
Okay. So, next point. For the record... let me catch up here. Okay, for the record, I have checked Campbell's statements in the above citation with the entry details for the 1611 folio at A.S. Herbert's Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1625 to 1961. They agree as to the contents of the preliminary material found in the 1611. So in other words, I have found Campbell, in my mind, to be wrong about a couple things. So when it came to what he's saying here about the preliminary material, I wanted to check it against a couple other sources to make sure that I thought he was right about this, and I think that he's right after having done some checking, okay? Dr. Donald L. Brake also comments on the preliminary material in his 2011 publication, A Visual History of the King James Bible. After listing out the preliminary material in like manner to Campbell above, Dr. Brake states the following, quote, "The translators were careful to include," notice what he says, "church-tailored resources, including a religious calendar, almanac, chart on how to find Easter, the order of the Psalms, and lessons, for morning and evening prayer. The introductory materials make it clear that the new 1611 version was intended for use in British churches." So, was the 1611 created for use in the church in England? Okay. One additional element one additional design element, and perhaps the translator's most revealing formatting decision, is reflected in their choice of the folio size for the first edition. The folio represents the largest Bible of the day, and folios were reserved for pulpit use. Since the work of the translation had been overseen by King James himself, the folio size represented the King James Version as the Bible issued under the king's authority to be used in churches throughout Britain. Smaller formats for personal use were then issued after the foundational folio first edition. And that's exactly what we see, right? Because in the very next year, 1612, do we start having octavos and quartos printed? Okay? All right, any questions about that introduction? So let's talk about the title page then. All right? As we have seen in our survey of pre-1611 English Bibles, the title page is often very thought out and intentional in what it means to convey to the reader. Recall the political statement that was made by the title page of the 1639 Great Bible that depicted King Henry, that should say King Henry VIII, so we need another Roman numeral on that one, Sylvia. Should be King Henry VIII, as the central figure, bigger than even God himself, distributing the word of God to the clergy and to the laity. See lesson 122 for our discussion of that. The title page of the 1611 King James Bible is no different. Okay, so here it is. You can see an image of it. Here is the title page. There's a bunch of information conveyed on the title page. All right, now, if you look at your notes, on page 6, you have a plain picture of the title page. Does everybody see that? Mm-hmm. But then if you go in your notes to page, what is this here? Go to page 11. The University of Texas at Austin published this in one of their university magazines, the anatomy of the title page, okay? And you can see, does this have annotations that break down what everything is in the image? Okay? So there's a lot of content that is crammed into the title page image, all right? So, I'm gonna go back to page 6 in my notes. So I gave you that as a cheat sheet if you need it, okay? So what I'm gonna do is I'm just gonna leave this page, this image, sort of on the screen, and we will sort of talk about it as we go through this. And we're probably only going to get through this point and then have to quit, okay? Gordon Campbell offers the following description of the figure and images found on the title page, okay? The more important of the two title pages in the 1611 Bible is a fine, engraving, I think. It's a typo. At the beginning of the volume, it is signed C. Bull, I'm not sure how you pronounce that word. Fesset in Richmond, 1611. Now, there it is at the bottom, okay? It's right there, bottom center. See, Bull in Richmond. Okay, so he is the artist who designed the title page, okay? Cornelius Bull was a Flemish draftsman and engraver who had previously worked in Antwerp and subsequently worked in the spring. So we need to flag that sentence. That doesn't seem right to me. Like something's missing.
There's a place named Spring. I looked it up.
Okay, so maybe it's fine. The reference to Richmond may imply he was living in Richmond Palace, which since 1610 had been the residence of Prince Henry, the Crown Prince, whose portrait Bull engraved, okay? So he is the artist of the title page from the 1611. The design is organized around a wall with two niches and a central recess. At the top of the wall is a cornice. Is that right?
Cornice
with tents and heretical shields of the 12 tribes. Okay, so what's he talking about? Let me zoom in. And he is talking about this right here. There are the shields of the 12 tribes sort of etched into this part right here. This is what it is meant to represent. Okay? The designs are adopted from those in the Bishop's Bible, but have been stripped of their landscape backgrounds. In the niche on the left stands Moses with a table and a rod. Okay? So this is Moses right here. He's carrying, obviously, what would be the Ten Commandments, and his staff or rod. This is Moses here on the image. All right? Then it says, on the left stands Moses with a table and rod. In the right niche, Aaron stands in his priestly robes. So this is Aaron and the robes of the high priest on this side of the image. Is everybody with that? Okay. The juxtaposition of Moses and Aaron is not unprecedented, but it is very unusual. It exists only in two Bibles printed in Louvain. I think that's in France. In part because Aaron rarely appears on title pages. The purpose of his inclusion is to emphasize the role of the priest in the English church. Okay? Now, is this political?
Yeah.
This is, so, there's a political motivation behind putting who here?
Aaron.
Okay? So, just like we saw there being political ramifications of the title page of the Great Bible, you have to think similarly here regarding the title page of the 1611. Okay? So, the purpose of his inclusion is to emphasize the role of the priest in the English church. Whereas Puritans insisted on the priesthood of all believers, the church saw the priest as a mediator of the teachings of the church to the laity, and Aaron is an emblem of that priesthood. His knife is a reminder that he offered sacrifices in the temple on behalf of God's people, and his cup recalls that he sprinkled the blood on the altar. His prominent position is a rebuke to Presbyterianism. Now here's the thing, okay? We look at the image in modern 21st century, and we don't get it. We don't get all the significant information that's communicated because we're out of touch with the historical context, right? But the inclusion of Aaron, he's got a knife. I forget where his knife is. Here's the knife. And here he's holding the blood of the sacrifice that would have been sprinkled on the mercy seat. Okay? So it is clearly a statement that would indicate that the priesthood is important. And again, we look at it and we're like, oh, that's cool artwork. Right? But would people of the day have looked at it and had a lot different understanding of it? Okay? At the top of the design, as in 1602, a representation of the Trinity, and Mike, help me out with this word, the tetragrammaton is again at the top, but on this occasion a dove is above the lamb, which allows the emblem of Christ to be connected with the world below. Okay, so notice, do you have the dove? Do you have the lamb carrying a cross? Okay, so read on. The other figures can be identified by traditional attributes. The four evangelists are all shown writing their Gospels. Matthew in the upper left, here he is. This is Matthew sitting here writing. Okay? Matthew in the upper left is accompanied by an angel holding an inkwell. So there's an inkwell right, there's an angel right here holding an inkwell, and Matthew is writing the Gospel of Matthew. Mark in the upper right, so here's Mark, is shown with a lion. Luke in the bottom left. So that would be down here. Here's Luke. Luke in the bottom left is portrayed with an ox. Here's the ox. John in the bottom right is shown with an eagle holding his inkwell. So down here is John, and there's an eagle here in this corner holding an inkwell. Okay? So you have the four evangelists now that are depicted, the four gospel writers. Okay? To the right of Matthew, so let's go back to the top. So here's Matthew. To the right of Matthew is Peter, who holds keys. So you see Peter here holding keys. Why would Peter be drawn holding keys? Because apostolic succession and authority says that Christ vested that in who?
Peter.
So is the image portraying information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So let me go back. So Peter, who holds keys, between them, Bartholomew stands with a tanner's knife with which he was to be flayed. So you'll notice here that the other apostles are often drawn holding the traditional implements of their death. Okay? To the left of Mark sits Paul. So this is Paul. To the left of Mark sits Paul, who holds a sword. Between him stands Simon with a saw, who was killed by being cut in half with a saw. Above the Lamb of God, and figure standing on the right is Andrew, holding the transverse cross of his martyrdom. So I believe that's right here, but I could be mistaken.
It's like the other saw. Side.
Other side? Oh, right here?
No.
Where?
Above the lamb, under the dove.
Right here?
Yeah.
Okay. Holding the transverse cross from Martin, the figure standing on the right is John the Apostle, who holds a chalice in his left hand. He is the same person as the evangelist in the lower right, because he appears here with his attribute of the apostle. Luke on the lower left was not an apostle, so does not appear above. Okay, so John is in the bottom corner, and he's also up here according to this description. Between Andrew and John, the apostle is shaded, the shaded figure of doubting Thomas. So that's right here. You can't really make him out. Okay? The shaded figure is... lost my spot. Shaded figure of doubting Thomas with a builder's square alluding to his activities in India. The shade represents the spiritual darkness of his doubt, John chapter 20, verse 25. At the bottom center, so that's down here, at the bottom center is the female pelican voling herself, that is, stabbing herself with her beak to feed her young with her own blood. This is an ancient image of Jesus voluntarily shedding his blood to redeem mankind. Here it is placed in a
cartouche,
which I believe is like this fancy
shield-y
deal. Not very artsy-fartsy, so you start calling these things by their proper names and I don't know, whatever, okay? Here he's placed in a cartouche similar to the one that encloses the Paschal Lamb. Together they represent the body and blood of Christ. So that would be the Lamb here at the front center, right there, okay? It is difficult to be confident about all the figures in the upper corners and in the back, so that would be these guys up in here and up in here. It's a little hard to know for sure. Behind Bartholomew are Jude, called Thaddeus in the Gospels, and there's some speculation about who those people might be. Go to page 8 of your notes. These images reflect a curious mixture of Protestant and Catholic sensibilities. Okay? So, you're never going to convince me that this wasn't done on purpose. All right? None of the human characters has a nimbus or halo. So if this was a Catholic draw, truly Catholic drawing, would they all have had the halo on them?
Yeah.
None of them do. Okay? The Godhead is represented by symbol rather than pictorial representations. Such features represent Protestant thinking. On the other hand, the figure of Peter is strikingly Catholic. Not only is he the sole possessor of the keys, Whereas on the Coverdale cover, all apostles had been issued with keys, but he is paired with Paul on the other side of the Godhead, which is the normal arrangement in Catholic altarpieces. Similarly, many of the apostles carry the instruments of their eventual deaths, as recorded in post-biblical accounts that are valued by Catholics, but ignored or even scorned by Protestants. Bull was presumably a Catholic. The previous year he made engravings for the life of Thomas Aquinas, as is apparent from his elevation of Peter, but he was alert to Protestant reservation about pictorial representation. So I would submit to you that the title page is itself emblematic of the political sensibilities of the age, the day and the age in which this Bible was translated. It has both Catholic and Anglican elements in it, and it is done intentionally in that way. Okay? Now, any questions about that? Now, we're just going to read, if there's no questions, I'm just going to read this next point on page 8. The phrase, appointed to be read in the churches, is an important phrase in my mind for a few reasons. So let me show you what I'm talking about, all right? I'm talking about this phrase right here, okay? Newly translated out of the original tongues with the former translations diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special commandment. Now look, appointed to be what?
Read
in churches. So what is the reason why they made this? To be read where? In church. Okay? So back to my notes. The phrase, appointed to be read in the churches, actually we need to strike the, it doesn't say the. So it just says, should just say, appointed to be read in churches, is an important phrase in my mind for a few reasons. First, as I discussed in lesson 182, when we were discussing the notes of John Boyce during the general meeting, the text was subjected to, I think that should say, an aureal review and fine-tuned for how it would sound when it was read out loud in a church service. Remember we talked about that? How they wordsmith it and tune it for the way it'll sound, and we talked about the Elizabethan aesthetic and how these guys were all reared in the age of Shakespeare and the age of the theater, and they knew about this, and the height of the English Renaissance and Enlightenment was the spoken word, right? That is the main art form that comes out of the English Renaissance, okay? So, first, so we got that, all right? Second, I think it speaks to the grandness and size of the first folio edition, which was clearly designed to be a pulpit Bible for use in public worship, okay? So if it's to be read in the churches and their first one is a massive folio, it is completely consistent with that statement that they would produce a first edition whose purpose and function would be to be the pulpit Bible in a church service to be read what? Out loud during the service. Are you following that?
Yep.
Okay. As we have seen, smaller sized, Bibles, plural, for personal use would come later. So the next year, 1612, you have the first octavos and quartos. Okay? Now, I want to stop there. So when we pick this up next Sunday, we're still talking about the title page, but I got a few more things I want to say here about the idea of it being appointed to be read out loud in the church. Okay? So what we're going to do is we'll have a break here. I'm going to subdivide off the notes. You guys just bring your normal notes. If I add anything to it, it'll just be something I read out loud, but we don't need to print a bunch of more notes, okay? Any questions? Now, let's just sort of back up before we quit. Do you still have that open or did you give up?
Gave up 10 minutes ago.
Did you ever try refreshing it?
Yeah.
And it still didn't work?
Several times, yeah.
Man. Satanic opposition, people. But so here's the thing. If you just look at that, would you miss a whole bunch of the stuff that that is communicating without an explanation from the person that created it, okay? And then I just want to end with this. I included this because I think it's helpful, because it walks you through, you know, identifying what everything is, and it has it all labeled for you there neatly. So I included the picture without the annotations, and then we included the annotated picture if you want to look at that. So eventually when these notes end up in a book, somebody would be able to look at not only the annotated one, but also the original image without the annotations. All right, any questions?
There was laws that you couldn't have Bibles, right?
By this point, those that had ended a long time before.
Even with the Catholics?
Though all that ended in the first half of the 16th century, like a good 70 to 80 years before the King James Bible is translated. We've covered that in material, in lessons before you guys started coming, if you're interested in hearing that discussion. Okay? And by this point, the Catholics are making an English Bible. They're making the Douay Rheims. They're making their own English Bible to compete with these Protestant English Bibles. All right, but we got to quit. Still not sure why we didn't go to YouTube.